What's up, Stitches? Welcome back to So What, the podcast about historical needlework hosted by me, Isabella Rosner. Can you believe it? 2 episodes in 2 weeks? It's a holiday season miracle. Today's episode is an interview with Dr. Elizabeth, or rather Liz, Gernard about her thrilling new book, The Modern Venus: Dress, Underwear, and Accessories in the Late 18th Century Atlantic World. So What is clearly in its talking to authors about books era, and I think that's really cool because there is just so much good textile and dress book content out in the world right now. You're probably thinking, but wait, what do dress, underwear, and accessories have to do with embroidery? Dress and textiles are very much connected, and embroidery is central to both, which you'll see is also the case in our conversation today. Bring on the embroidery! As you probably know at this point, you can find images of what we discuss in today's episode on our social media pages, and you can find these by searching So What Podcast, SEWWHAT Podcast, on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. We also have a website, and that is sowhatpodcast.com. Okay, so as I said, today I'm talking to Dr. Liz Gernard about her thrilling new book, The Modern Venus. The blurb for it reads, quote, "From rumps and stays to muffs and handkerchiefs, underwear and accessories were critical components of the 18th century woman's wardrobe. They not only created her shape, but expressed her character, sociability, fashionability, and even political allegiances. These so-called ephemeral flights of fashion were not peripheral and supplementary, but highly charged artifacts, acting as cultural currency in contemporary society. The Modern Venus highlights the significance of these elements of a woman's wardrobe in 1770s and 1780s Britain and the Atlantic world, and shows how they played their part in transforming fashionable dress when this was expanding to new heights and volumes. Dissecting the female silhouette into regions of the body and types of dress, and shifting away from a broad-sweeping stylistic evolution, this book explores these potent players within the woman's armory, marrying material, archival, and visual approaches to dress history, and drawing on a rich range of sources, including painted portraiture, satirical prints, diaries, and memoirs. The Modern Venus unpacks dress as a medium and mediator in women's lives. It demonstrates the importance of these overlooked garments in defining not just a woman's silhouette, but also her social and cultural situation, and thereby shapes our understanding of late 18th century life." End quote. I should say here that you probably heard the term satirical prints in there. It comes up a lot in our conversation. For those of you who don't know, satirical prints were essentially engravings that satirized things like daily life in Britain, famous people, popular fashions and pastimes, and political happenings. They were really popular in the late 18th century. Dr. Liz Gernard, whose full first name is actually Elizabeth, as I mentioned before, is a historian of 18th century dress, art, and material culture. She is a lecturer in design cultures at De Montfort University in the UK and former postdoctoral fellow at Historic Royal Palaces, UCLA, and the Paul Mellon Center for Studies in British Art. Okay, that's all the context you need, I think. Let's get into it. Liz, thank you so much for being here today. I feel like I've been waiting for your book for years, and then the cover was revealed, and I was like, oh my God. So the fact that we are here today, being able to talk about it, I love it. I'm so excited.
I'm very excited as well.
Yes. Yay. We got to get straight into it because there's a lot of ground to cover.
There is.
Okay. So how did you come to write this book? It's the question I always ask anybody on this podcast. It's basically your origin story.
Effectively, I started being inspired or wanting to do dress history as a kid, as I think most of us.
Relatable.
Most of us had the same experience. My grandmother was an editor for Brides Magazine, so she got me interested in historic fashion specifically.
Oh, wow.
And then I got to uni and tried really hard to figure out how to do dress history without knowing it was a thing yet. And so I did a history and history of art degree that worked my way towards that and worked my way into, you know, getting to what was actually dress history. I then very luckily found my supervisor, Vicky Coltman, who said, yes, This is totally a thing.
Yes.
Welcome to the 18th century. Oh. So that's how I ended up in the 18th century. And actually, that is where the first part of this book actually started in my undergrad.
That is amazing, to be honest.
And then it continued into a master's, and then it continued into a PhD. Again, I'm sure you've heard the story a lot, but effectively there was a couple of moments which were really helpful for me in figuring out how I wanted to do dress history once I figured out that dress history was a field.
Real.
And as you will have guessed, and as my cover perhaps says, I look at satirical prints, and that that's one of my cornerstones. That's one of my main bodies of evidence. So it was a moment of, I think, actually starting to give credit where credit's due. Like most of my students that I have now today, it was looking at Valerie Steele's The Corset, because once again, that was the
classic.
Exactly. That was the book that was out. And looking at the satirical prints in there, which, you know, now I've actually, that kind of started me thinking of, oh, this is where I can find fashion in a way that I hadn't thought about before, which then led to effectively my love affair with satirical prints, which, yeah, it's kind of how that link was originally made. But then after my PhD, I had a really nice amount of headspace. I was able to step back, which was necessary. And that's when I was able to do a bunch more postdocs and fellowships, because what do you need after a PhD is more research.
True.
And more primary evidence. And then I was able to kind of figure it out of what the glue was, because there was always this connection that I was making in satirical prints at the time. So in the 70s and 80s, you get this sort of five-piece ingredient list. And they use recipes, you know, you find recipes which are published in the book, which people are pretty familiar with, of like how to build a woman sartorially effectively. Mm-hmm. But it was trying to figure out how to make that glue stick. It's the how-to guide for a specific period of history, a specific time.
Very fun one. And I feel like one of the things that's really cool about your book for somebody like me who studies textiles and needlework is I think so often about paper as part of the production process. When it comes to embroidery, it's things like patterns, you know, and right, like ladies' magazines, you talk about them in the book. But for your work, it kind of turns that on its head. It's about, it's paper in response to the finished product. How are these cartoons making fun of, poking fun at, modern dress and how women build up the idealized form. Mm-hmm. Also, what a way to start the book. Okay, so I'm just going to paint the picture of how I started this book. I was on the train to work. It's 8 a.m. I open the book, and like the first image that you see is, I'm now opening the book again, just to relive the experience. The first image you see is, I would say, like a kind of Kardashian-esque figure, exaggeratedly so, right? Mm-hmm. The chest is chesting in a massive way. The booty is out and about all over the place. It's it's kind of very in line with what we would consider, I think, a fashionable woman's shape, very shapely, very busty and bootylicious.
Very.
Never said that word before on this podcast, but here we go.
Well, this is the book to do it.
It is indeed totally the book to do it. Can you take us on a walk through the book?
The image that you're talking about is called The Modern Venus. It's where the book gets its name from. And it is a drawing that was given to Horace Walpole by his sister. And it's painted, or it's drawn by Mary Hoare, who is, if you look at her other surviving works, this is very uncharacteristic, especially for a female artist at the time. A lot of her works are tableaus of Shakespeare, and this was given in the style of the Modern Venus, and that's the text underneath of, you know, what women are looking like in 1786, which 1786 and 1787 are the the apex. They're the peak of effective artificiality in terms of dress. So if we're thinking about, the book technically starts in the 60s, sort of the late 60s, and goes to the mid 90s. And you have, from the late 60s, you've got the wide shape of hoops and paniers that are still, and they don't disappear entirely. I'm not arguing that. But effectively, as you go into the 70s, that's when things, you know, you narrow at the waist in terms of the volume goes from the hips and to the bum. And then you sort of elongate. And the 70s is when you get the really big hair. That's when you get that kind of much more pointed. And this has been discussed by other scholars looking at other forms of dress. But then it rounds out in the 80s. So in the 80s is when you get sort of orbs and spheres. Again, it's still the same areas, but that's when the bust comes in. And then it kind of tapers off into the 90s when we get more into, quote, Jane Austen. Effectively, it's looking at the various elements that take us through that. And it starts with that drawing. And what happens with the drawing, it's wonderful. It's given to Walpole by his sister. Don't know how, never. There's connections between his sister and Nahor, but there's no letters saying, hey, this is how I bought this, etc. That would be too good. But effectively, Horace Walpole sends it to his friend and longtime correspondent, Lady Arcery. And she, you know, saying, look at my present, like, look at my modern Venus. I think it's great. I'm going to have my private secretary, who also happens to be a printer, print it for distribution. She sends it back, and she sends a version back to him. So she's traced it, because there's two surviving drawings. And her drawing, she's added clothes. So she's added a dress. She's added the muslin bouffant or handkerchief around the neck. She's added a hat. The only thing that she didn't add, which is the last component of my book, is a muff. But it's this exchange of, you have this body shape, which is not amplified. And it is outrageous to the modern eye. It's not amplified by plastic surgery. It's not amplified by tight lacing. It's amplified by, you know, it's not amplified by women going to insane things, but it's amplified by underwear and accessories. And that's what fascinated me between this exchange. It's then printed and it is published. So you have these, you know, this succession of how print and clothing interact and how paper interacts and how we get this response to fashion. But with that body, you have a lot going on. So it was effectively building that body type. So, you know, we start with the handkerchief, we start with effectively the breast that we see with her, and then get into hats and headwear, and specifically calashes, which are boned hoods. And then we get into cork rumps. So that's the second half. But I feel like what you're really interested is in the muffs.
I am.
I feel like that's
that's what I'm here for. You chatted a big game about embroidery and I was loving it. So could you, for the listeners, could you explain what a muff is? Thank you.
A muff is a cylindrical garment which you put your hands into generally in the colder months. They originally, and are most commonly as we think of them, is made of fur. So they arrive, I think it's the 16th, all these dates are in the book. They arrive, I think, in the 16th century.
I trust you.
So you've got the fur on one hand. And with the fur comes all of the double entendre, which will be hilarious for most of your British listeners. Less hilarious for your North American. It was one of those things that, did it translate for us? I don't know. So we've got fur muffs on one hand. You also have feather muffs, which I've written about elsewhere. But what interested me in this book was silk muffs. And that's where embroidery comes in.
That's where we're at today.
Yep.
Embroidery fans who are not fashion historians have probably been listening to this conversation being like, why am I here?
Why are we listening to this?
Welcome back, everybody.
Yep. Hi.
There's embroidery everywhere all the time. Don't you worry.
It is. And actually, the embroidery of embroidered muffs, and that, again, I'm sure that some of your listeners are well aware, You've got when in the sort of steps of embroidery making for young women, a muff is different than a pocket. A pocket is invisible. It's for you. You can mess up. It doesn't have to, you know, it's a very personal and intimate thing that no one else is going to see unless you choose to show them.
Totally.
A muff is visible. A muff you're wearing, it can also be worked quite, you know, it's a small amount of fabric. It's a rectangle. It doesn't take up much space. So it's not as big or as cumbersome as doing a gown or doing something, you know,
it's smaller
anything,
yes,
anything
yes.
Big kid dress doesn't have, you know. So it's a smaller project. It's manageable, but it is also very visible. And how I got into how I first found my first embroidered muff is this letter from a girl named Frances Mabel Sparrow, who lives in, yep, she lives in Spath, not Bath, but Spath.
Spath,
which is
a silly name.
Which is a teeny tiny hamlet. It's about 120 miles north of London. And she writes to her cousin, Henrietta Pennington, who she calls Henny, saying, I've just learned embroidery and I'm quick in love with it. And it's wonderful. It's the most beautiful letter. I know. And it's this whole, again, you know, correspondence between the two cousins who she really looks up to her cousin. She looks up to her cousin who lives in Kensington gravel pits. So not quite the most fashionable part of London at the time, but effectively it's this looking up to her cousin in a kind of a, you're a really good embroiderer. Can you find me some patterns? Can you send me some patterns from the capital? Send me what's in fashion, which again, this is I know, but it was just this, the quick in love with it. And it was the idea that she was ready to try her hand at, you know, harder shading and things like that. And she was ready. And she specifically asks for a pattern for a muff.
Oh, yes. I mean, yeah. I think it's just so lovely. I have just learned embroidery and I'm quick in love with it. And also that she cites it as being her cousin's favorite employment. I mean, delightful. But it makes a lot of sense that, like, embroidery is kind of central to conversations about how to create and form the female body in this period, because it's, you know, the female body as, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir master here, right? That, like, it's all about an exaggerated kind of femininity, femalehood, right? It's the big butt, it's the big chest, that sort of thing. Again, Kim Kardashian-y. And in this period where embroidery is so tied up in how to be a good woman, how to be a good white mother and daughter, it makes a lot of sense that embroidery and shaping the body come together. And it feels very evocative that it's coming together in a space as kind of central on the body as a mother. You know, double entendre aside, it's right in the center.
And it's for me, what was interesting with specifically embroidered muffs was the haptics. It was the, it was, and again, this is well-trodden ground of, you know, imbuing meaning and imbuing, like, physically stitching meaning and stitching sentiment and connection. And that I found whenever I've looked at embroidery, of it's that no matter what the aim is there, it's more weighted than sewing for construction's sake or sewing for living's sake in terms of a practical day to day. It has that, you know, extra connection, which, so Frances Mabel Sparrow's aunt's aunt is Mrs. Delaney. So is Mary Delaney. So,
yes.
Yep.
We love Mary Delaney. Yep. For those of you who are listening to this podcast, go back to maybe it's in season one or season two, an episode about Mary Delaney, Mary Morris Knowles, and Mary Linwood. In one of the first seasons, all about Mary Delaney, who we love, very good needleworker. She created all these paper mosaics, collages. We stand. We have nothing but love for Mary Delaney. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. So you've got this connection between the two of them, and she was really fond of Frances, and they exchange letters and they correspond. Effectively, Frances kind of takes her the place. It's, I think it's after her sister's death, Delaney's death, Delaney's sister's death. But yes, they do have this really nice relationship. Again, big generational gap, but they have this really sentimental relationship. Mary Delaney makes a lot of different types of art. She makes a lot of different types of things and objects. But I was always really, it was confirming that sort of haptic working and haptic meaning and expression that goes into embroidery. And for me, it just happened to be through the canvas of a muff, which was always really lovely.
I mean, it's, I feel like what you were just talking about and the quotes that you include in throughout the book, but in this particular section, it's all about women connecting to each other. That's such a central part of embroidery, has been for so long. The sociability and the community that comes through stitch. It's about a younger cousin asking an older cousin. It's about your niece asking the great aunt. It's all about, it's women teaching women how to be fashionable women.
So what's interesting for me is that this is the written side. So these are, I have no idea what Frances Mabel Sparrow may have made.
Right.
I have no material record. I have no evidence at all. But from the flip side, there are the two pink muffs in the book, which are at LACMA. They came into LACMA's collection at the same time. They've got the same, the provenance is not there, but they entered at the same time. They effectively had the same accession numbers. And I'm fairly convinced, ignoring, you know, obviously there's room for doubt, but that they're the same maker. So they've got a couple of hallmarks. So they both use ribbon work embroidery. They both have pink satin bows attached to them, and they both have linen lace around, which the three together aren't, quote, normal. It wasn't, you know, that wasn't the fashion that everyone was doing. So for me, and you can take the first one, which is very 70s, it has that kind of diagonal patterns. But then the second one has the more 80s medallion shape, then these little sprigs that are sort of more scattered around. And what I love is that in one of the sprigs, you can see her, I mean, you can see her pencil marks effectively all over these muffs. But one of them, the sprig is, she's just decided, nope, not doing it.
Leaf too big? That leaf is too big.
And she completely reorientates it. She ignores that pattern, but I find looking at them, for me at least, because the patterns improve, or not improve, but the patterns progress with what was fashionable. For me, I'm like, it looks to me as if this is the first one, and then this is a later one. And you can see her skill developing. So, see?
Crying in a nice
there's
way.
There's embroidery.
There's Let's be real. There's always embroidery. It's everywhere. And I'm glad that you recognized that and brought it in. So thank you.
I do. I totally do. It's one of my, I think it's probably one of my favorite parts. It was always, Frances, I don't often talk about real women. That's part of the book, is that I'm talking about archetypes. I'm talking about effectively women through the lens of satirical prints. But Frances Mabel Sparrow is one of my real women. And Frances Mabel Sparrow is one of my, you know, she's one of my, you know, she's stuck with me.
So. Wow. I have one/two final muff thoughts. And then I will ask you about other parts of your book, because there are other parts of your book.
We can just keep talking about muffs. It's fine.
Honestly, this could just be an entirely muff.
We can change the title and you can just call
it muffs. That's right. It's the modern muff now, actually. I mean, thank you so much.
Well, dear Bloomsbury, sorry.
Sorry, it's only been out for like 2 weeks.
We've changed it.
So much of this book is about, it's what you were saying with pockets. Pockets are secret. Stays are secret. The things that built up the body, you know, everybody knew what the kind of component parts were to create this body, but like they weren't, unless it was through the lens of a satirical print, you weren't like going outside with your cork rump on if they existed. Nope. Or your like stays, right? That was a secret for you. Whereas these are public. They're for outsider consumption. They're for public consumption. But I find it so fascinating that the thing that made the muff, the hand, it's about the maker's hand, that is what becomes secret. The work of their hand is public, but the actual hands themselves, the things that did this very fine embroidery, now they're concealed. What a fascinating thing. Hands.
Muffs effectively lead me to, I would say an obsession. I'm going to say that. It's an obsession. It effectively, for a very brief time, Not that embroidery goes away, because embroidery is still part of it. Kind of usurps embroidery for just a moment. And that's satin prints. So that's... It happens. It starts in 17... I think my earliest is 1782. It's very short-lived. It's absolutely wonderful. And I found them originally through looking at muffs in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And there's three in their collection, which are all in the book. And they, I mean, it's introducing all the hallmarks of the 80s. You've got spangles, you've got, so it's just taking slightly, you know, where you can see the design elements from embroidery and how it's evolving and how it's kind of taking this journey on the front of these muffs. But there's a teeny tiny on one of them. There's a teeny, teeny tiny printed inscription that's Bartolozzi and Kaufman. So it's telling you the artist, and it's telling you the etcher. So it's telling you that this these are after Angelica Kaufman, and they're by Bartolozzi, which led me into finding out, you know, finding them on paper, finding their paper counterparts, finding when they were published, how, you know, and you have this whole satin print effectively phase. And for me, it's that actual melding of not necessarily, you've got this melding of print and fashion physically, and where they're both actually combining. But in terms of makers, which is why I'm bringing them up, I'm not just shoehorning satin prints in. but it's the idea that it's supporting a different maker. It's supporting a patron. It's supporting Kaufman and Angelica Kaufman. So yeah, so that's this kind of, it's not necessarily the maker of the muff, which you do get professional makers, you do get, like you get professional embroiderers, and you get professional embroiderers selling patterns and or ready-made, you know, already made up, et cetera. But for the majority, you get people making their own. And for me, while you may not have been able to afford a Kaufman oil painting, you know, you could afford a satin print.
It's again, like this lineage of women. It's a, it's an artist who's a woman, you know, okay, there's a man involved. That's fine. Angelica Kaufman being stitched by a woman, then worn by a woman. It's all about, I don't know, gender is not a binary, but in this situation, it's a lot of kind of women and women and women.
And that was a choice in terms of, I did have to, there's, I think there's technically, you know, there's one man, the Prince of Wales makes it. Pretty sure. But again, it's that inversion of gender, and it's that challenge, it's because he's wearing stays, and it's because it's responding to the tight lacing series. But effectively, yes, this is a book about women, and it is a book about fairly elite, generally white, nearly 100% white women, which was actually dictated actually through satirical prints. This was, it's very hard to find. I can think of one. And again, this is something I need to explore more. This is something I want to look at more. But before the 1790s, Black women don't, they're not necessarily featured in the way that I'm looking at fashion prints or prints that actively use fashion, which has always been an interesting, you know, trying to find that and then realizing, hold on, I'm just missing this category entirely. And then hold on, I can't even search for it within library catalogs. So this is one of those, labels are important and we haven't quite gotten there yet. And for me, starting with the image of the modern Venus from an 18th century, like from a late 18th century, early 19th centuryist person who's been around, you can't get the Hottentot Venus out of your head.
Yeah. Can you explain what that is for the people who don't know?
Yes. In the at the effectively at the turn of the century, a woman named Sarah Bartman, whose a lot of work has been written by absolutely fantastic people. Charmaine Nelson's work gets into more marble and whiteness, but Robin Mitchell, Dia Hartman, they've all written about her. This woman who has that kind of body type. So effectively, she's from originally South Africa, or what would become South Africa. And she has a very big bum, and she has kind of, and then they essentially accentuate her bust as well. But effectively, she was put on display, and money was made. Money. She was effectively a very early version of sort of what we think of as like a very 19th century kind of circus freak show idea. Mm-hmm. And, you know, money was made, and then a lot of printed images were also made. So there's a lot of prints of her, and they're always in profile. They're always there. Everyone is in profile. There's not one that's not. So it's all showing this. And then after her death, her body was actually cast in bronze and kept for, quote, scientific, using really big air quotes.
Dang, she was so screwed over, wasn't she? Oh,
very much so. And I mean, she embodies very much this objectification and at the same time, exotification, and at the same time, complete diminishment. And a lot of, especially Hartman's work emphasizes the lack of Black women who are often called Venus. So you have,
interesting.
Yes, there's especially enslaved women were often called Venus, or there's a lot of Venuses out there in terms of the record. So it is this element which I was very conscious of, because when you look at that first plate, it's 20 years before, you know, the image of Sarah Bartman is ever produced. You know, she's not there yet, but it was that kind of conscious thing of, because of our sort of historical position of we're looking back through all this later evidence and later images, it was how to not disentangle, but how to acknowledge that this predates it in a way that it's not necessarily reflective. But yeah, it's a challenge. Yeah. And it's one of these things of, it would have been, it speaks to effectively what was considered fashionable. And it speaks to what was considered fashionable at this time of, A, you have enough money to afford this. You're at least in the Jane Austen genteel category. You know, you've got enough money. You are white. You are straight. You are very tick boxing. Tick boxing? Tick boxes.
I love it. Tick boxing. Yeah, great.
Tick boxing. So it was one of those things of figuring out this specific material, which, again, mm-hmm. it's portraying what was fashionable, and it's portraying how to build the ideal woman. And the ideal woman has all of those categories and doesn't necessarily live in the margins. I think I'm preempting the idea of that whiteness itself is fashionable, and that's, you know, obviously it comes into its own later, but again, it's that kind of idealized, it's white has always been fashionable because it's always meant money, and it's always meant labor, and it's always meant you can keep it clean and by right. you I mean your army of people making it clean for you, and laundering it.
That's, I think, an important thing to think about and talk about when it comes to this period generally in Britain. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. the fashionable woman, the fashionable body, the fashionable embroidery. Mm. It's white.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's totally. Whiteness. Mm-hmm. And we can't, yeah, I think we can't divorce race from this sort of conversation. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate you bringing it up.
No, but it's also that, I mean, because I'm talking a lot about dichotomies. It's artifice versus nature. It's beauty versus not beauty. But effectively, they're still ignoring larger dichotomies around race. And when they do address it, it doesn't get the lighthearted. It gets a much more disparaging view. So it gets a much more disparaging lens.
No, yeah, I think you're so right. Satirical prints sit so interestingly, I feel like, in this world of the late 18th century, because you're right with the dichotomy. It's about drama and about exaggeration in a way that, like, the embroidery, it's all going to come back to embroidery all the time. Sorry.
Hey, I'm here for it.
Thank you. The embroidery at this time is like, you know, even garden design and so many other art forms. It's about trying to mimic nature. It's trying to kind of minimize the dichotomy between the artificial and the natural in a way that satirical prints, I think, are actually kind of further emphasizing that gap between the two.
I've never found a satirical embroidery that's been translated into, well, no, a satirical print that's translated into an embroidery.
How interesting. How weird, because in this period, embroidery is so about engaging with literature and engaging with the print, right? It's what you're saying with this printed silk thing. It's about making your morning pictures that are based on Angelica Kauffman prints.
So this was, again, bringing it back to embroidery.
Thank you.
when I found those first satin prints, and I lost my tiny mind, and it began. What had been written about satin prints at the time was exclusively about needlework pictures, painting. It was exclusively about that specific idea that, yes, Angelica Kauffman's work, who was soft and allegory and feminine and lent itself beautifully to interiors and furniture. And that was the thing. It was just, yes, these were created, but they were created for, I guess you could say cartoons, if we're thinking in a tapestry terminology. If we're borrowing the terminology from tapestry, they were cartoons. And effectively what you would stitch over, I don't know, embroider by numbers, you know, as your well-trained connoisseurial eye, I'm sure has looked at multiple of these and said, ah, yes, I can see, because they haven't done the face.
Right.
And that is it's printed silk. So you have these which are being published, but for my interest in my work was effectively looking at it when they weren't for needlework paintings.
It went the other way.
Mm-hmm. Wow. When it was, well, we don't actually need them for it. Or, you know, that wasn't their intended purpose of when they became fashion themselves.
What is your favorite print in the book, and what is your favorite object in the book?
I think it has to be the cover image.
So good.
Which is 1786, a conveyance into the regions of folly, or the ladies' dress of the year 1786. It had never been digitized, like much of the Library of Congress's collection. And I found it in person in 2016, the day after the election, and it brought such joy, and it brought such humor. And it was, again, this probably turning point for me of making the book into the book, in that way of, how do I get to her? How do I take this material? And it's playing off the popularity of balloon dress, and it's playing off the idea of, if we're going back to those muslin handkerchiefs that are artificially amplifying the bosom. So, you know, yes, your stays can mold and shape things in certain ways, but it's then amplified by these really fine layers of muslin, which is not for modesty. It's see-through. It's totally see-through. But you have, it's just giving that proportion. And it's, if you make this bigger, and if you make your bust line bigger and higher, and if you make your bum higher, you make your waist look smaller, not higher, bigger. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It has that kind of, it's all about visuals. So effectively, one of the newspapers was advertising amongst balloon mania with bouffants, which is their sort of term at the time, is that there were helium was used to, like, gas was used to create this artificial bust. And then it just has, but it's contributing to that idea of balloon mania at the time of Lunardi's flight in 1784. And it just has that amplification. She effectively embodies this concept of what the modern Venus is, which is not the classical, you know, anything natural body type. So she's the favorite print. And I think the favorite object is actually multiple objects, because it's a doll in Colonial Williamsburg at the DeWitt Wallace Museum. She has a complete 1780s wardrobe, and it's fabulous. It's everything in miniature. It's perfect. It's lovely. And for my purposes, it shows a lot of things that don't necessarily survive in, you know, their big kid form.
That's a good one. I love her. You have a lot of, like, really nice close-ups of her, and the tiny stitches in the stain.
It's petite. Whoever made her was meticulous. So
an icon, to be honest. That's okay. This is a good combo between the print and the object.
Yeah.
And because this is a needlework podcast, after all, I have to ask you, what is your favorite, outside of this book, what is your favorite needleworked object?
So I have three, but they're related. So my great grandfather made crewel work embroidery, and we have a fireplace screen, we have a bell pull, and then an overmantel piece, which is all crewel work, which I think he did in around the 30s. But yeah, so that's my.
Oh, I'm living. That's so good. Yeah. People have said frequently on this podcast that favorite objects are things from their family, but you're actually the first person to have a favorite object from a male family member. Do you have anything you'd like to promote? I know part of why you're here is to promote. So tell me.
Well, funny you should ask. I've written this book. So and crazy. I'm promoting the book. I know. You're shocked. Yes. that's I would say the main thing I'm promoting. If you want to hear a more in-depth discussion about specifically probably the breast of Venus, so specifically muslin and that kind of house satirical prints, are why I'm interested in as much the balloon lady as, you know, a painting. I will be giving a talk with the IHR long 18th century series on January 24th. So, which you can access
the new year.
Zoom.
Hey.
So yeah, so they will be shortly getting an abstract and a title.
Exciting.
But yeah. Exciting. But yeah, no, effectively, I would like to promote the modern Venus. The really nice thing about Bloomsbury is that it's not extortionate. It's not old school academic book prices. And it's also largely, I mean, it's hopefully written in a way that people who are not in the world of academia can also enjoy and relate to and find joy in.
Liz, it has been a joy, a treat, an honor to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me and for letting me talk about muffs for a very long time.
Hello again. What a super fun conversation with Liz. Our conversation covered a lot of ground, but I like that it always returned to that relationship between paper and fabric. As I mentioned in our chat, I do often think about paper when it comes to embroidery, but only in really specific ways. It crosses my mind when thinking about the early modern pattern books that were disseminated around Europe and which influenced embroidery around the world for centuries. And I think of people drawing out their embroidery designs and writing letters to each other about their needlework, like Frances Mabel Sparrow did. But I don't think as often as I should about how paper can reflect fashion and how printed paper can add to our understanding of embroidery. In fashion prints, we sometimes see women embroidering, and we can envision what they were wearing when they were doing so. We see depictions of how embroidery was worn on the body and in the home. And in one print, a satirical print by James Gilray in 1812, titled Farmer Giles and His Wife Showing Off Their Daughter Betty to Their Neighbors on Her Return from School, a sampler hangs on the wall of a family home. According to the print's catalog entry on the Victoria and Albert Museum website, quote, "The theme of the humble family aspiring to a higher social position was a common one in 18th and early 19th century caricature. In this print, a farmer's family has sent their daughter to a boarding school instead of keeping her at home to learn the ways of the farm. Now returned, they have invited neighbors to hear the girl play piano and sing, and to look through her drawings. Music, drawing, embroidery, dancing, and other accomplishments were the typical skills taught in most girls' schools at the time." End quote. Even in satirical prints, we get peeks at embroidery. This conversation with Liz has encouraged me to think more about the relationship between paper and textile, and I hope it has for you too. And that's that for So What's 2023 episodes. Can you believe it? Wow. I will see you in 2024. Now go out and stitch some stories and bring back the muff. Bye.